voice of the international African revolution.
What will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just the life is all I got in a parade of centuries. People cried out and said, please, please, we want freedom, liberation, and just some help in this civilization. And though I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just the life is all I got. What did they do? What did they say to justify speaking this way? Have they just fought and often cried? And when they turned around, were shot down and died. Oh, but I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just the life is all I had at. Munchie and John walked through this maze. They touched a million lives in a thousand ways, 60 and 10. Never knew them. 26 and 23 is all they were. Oh, can't you see? Didn't you hear the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just the life is all I got.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north. Norman Otis Richmond, I am the bluesologist and the Bama that's based in Toronto, Canada. And we came out of the box tonight with the music of Elaine Brown. She did a song called Assassination. And we're going to have Elaine Brown on today, and we're also going to be speaking with Raymond Nat Turner about the birthday of Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, the Deputy Minister of Defense for the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party. And I would like to thank two people, Omali Ishitella and Archie Shepp. Omali Ishitella, Chairman Omali Ishitella, gave me the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and Archie Shepp gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And today we're going to be paying tribute to Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, who was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I would like to play an interview with Geronimo G. Jaga. Geronimo G. Jaga got his name from, he was named by Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. And Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was a student of African and Native American history. He was very fluent in that. And so we're going to listen to Geronimo talk about meeting Bunchy. And then we're going to play a song that is my theme song, called The Spiritual. We're going to play the whole, we're going to play a portion of it. It's 10 minutes and 30 seconds long, but The Spiritual was, it's my theme song, and a lot of people like it, and it features John William Coltrane. It also features Eric Allen Dolphy, Jr. on bass clarinet, and Eric Allen Dolphy, Jr. was from Los Angeles, California. He went to school at a school called Dorsey High School, and he was very close to John William Coltrane, and he had a very interesting background. One of his parents, I know, was born in Panama, and I think one of his parents was also born in St. Kitts. Also, John Huggins, who was killed with Al Prentiss Bunchy Carter, he was born in New Haven, Connecticut, but one of his parents was born in Nevis, which is a sister island of St. Kitts. And also, the song features Reggie, still in the land of the living workmen. He is playing bass, and this would be Reggie Workman's final recording with Coltrane. As by December 1961, Jimmy Garrison was announced as the replacement, stabilizing a lineup which would remain constant for the next 4 years. McCoy, still in the land of the living, Tyner is on piano, and the late great Elvin Jones is playing, drums. And this is what the Downbeat critics, the Caucasian critics from Downbeat said about Coltrane and Eric Dolphy. They said, they described the group as musical nonsense, being peddled in the name of jazz, and as a horrifying demonstration of what appears to be a growing anti-jazz trend, end of quote. So let's listen to Alan, Eric Dolphy, and John William Coltrane, and The Spiritual.
I never forget. I used to teach knife throwing in the Army. I always do a knife, you know, and bayonet throwing. So I'm standing there in the front yard of this house on Smiley Drive, throwing my knife. I threw underhand into this tree, I guess about 10 paces away, and I go get it, and I'm throwing, and Al is inside the house, and the next thing I know, I noticed a brother coming with a bad natural, and he had this sister with him. This was one of the most beautiful sisters I had. She had a woolly belly. And they was coming down a walkway because it had a cyclone fence in between the sidewalk. And so I'm, you know, waiting to speak. I'm from down home. I'm going to speak to you, you know, but I'm doing what I'm doing. So when I throw and they come in, I notice he's coming in. And I'm kind of looking at Marvel, that was her name, this fine sister with the miniskirt. But the brother, he goes to my knife, and he pulled it out the tree. And he come back to me, he smiled, looked at him, and we had no words ever passed. By then, Al Jackson is standing on the porch, looking, smiling. And I don't say nothing, he spoke maybe, but Bunchy came back to where I was standing, and threw that knife over his shoulder and landed almost exactly where I had thrown that knife. And I smiled and walked up and went and got the knife and pulled it out. And I came back to him, took 2 paces back further. Now, all this is happening without us saying nothing. Ask Al. If Bunchy go get the knife, come back 2 paces where I was at, threw it, and it bounced because the knife came toward Marva. And that's when the silence was broken. We all start talking. And Al said, hey, you finally met. And that's when the Donald went, oh, this is Bunchy. This is who I'm supposed to meet. That's how we met.
listening to Diasporic Music on Uhura Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, the bluesologist based in Toronto, Canada. Nanga Def is Wolof, and Wolof is the language of the people of Senegal, Mauritania, and many people in the Western Hemisphere speak Wolof. It's the language of Yusu Endor, and we're going to play some music from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, right now. And in a few moments, we're going to be speaking with Raymond Nat Turner, and later we will be speaking with Elaine Brown. And Elaine Brown is going to be talking about Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. Today's show is dedicated to the memory of Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. And this is Norman Otis Richmond. Let's go to Ouagadougou.
Bye. Hey, Aisha, hold on. I'll walk with you. You know, this is going to be a great class.
I know. Yet I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow. Sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up today.
And hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist and the Bama, based in Toronto, Canada. And joining me on the line from New York City is the poet in residence of Black Agenda Report, and an all-around great poet, Raymond Nat Turner. How are you doing today, my friend?
I'm cool. How about yourself up there in Toronto?
In the cold, it's getting winter's is coming. But I wanted to let you talk about Raymond Nat Turner first. You know, you are originally from Los Angeles. You're based in New York now. But, you know, you have a few things that I think listeners would like to know. You have some CDs, and can you talk about the work that you do at Black Agenda Report in terms of you write a poem every week, I believe.
sometimes I do.
Well, wait a minute. I haven't missed any. Have I been missing some stuff? Am I smoking something? I thought I'd see Mr. Turner in there every week.
Yeah, it's kind of happened like that. That was never the intention from the outset, but it sort of evolved like that. And I think partly it's a function of being in New York with a different kind of energy.
Right. And you're listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. I don't know if we've lost Raymond. I cannot hear him.
I'm here.
Oh, okay. I got you. Okay. Sorry about that. That was my fault.
Okay. Yeah, and what I was saying, you were saying I do a poem a week at Black Agenda Report. And what I was saying is that it sort of evolved into something like that. That was never a plan going into things, and it's somewhat a function of being in New York with the energy that's here.
Right, right. All right, so I wanted to encourage people to check you out on Black Agenda Report whenever you're on Black Agenda Report, but today we are going to speak about Al Prentice Bunchy Carter. And Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was born on October the 12th, 1942. And your mother knew Bunchy Carter and actually hired Bunchy Carter to work at a place called the Teen Pulse. And could you talk about your relationship with Al Prentice Bunchy Carter?
Woo! That's a huge subject. The thing that's interesting when you're dealing with a figure like him is that he could be anything to anyone depending on what they brought to the equation, what they were looking for. And in my particular case, being the oldest in my family, I was always looking out for an older brother, a big brother. And so when I met him, initially, my very first meeting with him, I met him at the Teen Post. My mother introduced me to him, and initially I didn't like him. And why I didn't like him was interesting because he was really kind and warm, actually. And I thought it was somewhat of an act, you know, because a lot of times people would do that in the presence of my mom, you know, because my mom, she had a real presence, and she had a long history as being an organizer there, and she had numerous contacts and a lot of influence. And so sometimes people would behave in certain ways, and being young people, you know, young people and old people can usually detect when people are putting on airs and so forth. And so that's what I thought it was initially, but my assessment proved to be rather, you know, quite wrong, quite incorrect. He was just genuinely interested in myself and my younger brother. Look at him as an older brother, and he had a tremendous influence on the lives of both myself and my younger brother. It was so interesting because he was Apprentice Bunchy Carter was a poet, and
right,
he was the first poet I had ever seen, I ever met in person, I ever, you know, witnessed practice the art, the craft in person. And so, of course, it influenced me greatly and made me want to pursue that. And so,
and you did.
And I did, yeah. I did. And he was so influential. I mean, he was, you know, really. Oh, God, he's, you know, one of a kind. You know, when you talk about jazz and you talk about the Mumm and you talk about Trains and Cecil Taylors and Ornettes, well, he was that in his own realm, whether, you know, in the realm of politics and the realm of organizing. He was that. And my brother took Bunchy and applied him to sports. That was, you know, he played football, and he, you know, patterned himself after Bunchy on the football field, and he played baseball, and the same thing there. And so it was very, you know, it's just kind of funny, you know, thinking back. Yeah, he had a tremendous influence on us younger ones, and we really looked up to him. And he was really a natural-born teacher. You know, I mean, he was one of those teachers who could teach without teaching, you know, or he would be teaching, in other words. And before meeting Bunchy, I knew Masai, because Ray Masai Hewitt, or Raymond Hewitt, was assistant director at that Teen Post that my mother ran. And when he left, that's when Bunchy came into the picture. And the thing I'm not clear on, that even to this date, is meet him in 66 or 67. It's not altogether clear to me, and the reason that's important is because it seems, when you're young like that, it seems as though, you know, the summers and the days and the weeks and go on forever. But as you get older, you start to see how brief they are, how they just move, you know, inexorably, you know. And so, you know, is that if it was 66, well, I only got to know him for, you know, roughly 3 years, or maybe not even that, or 67. It was only 2+ years. But it seemed like a very long time because of the intensity of our connection. Firstly, you know, that connection was in the form of my mom hiring him to work as her assistant director at the Teen Post, which was very, you know, very interesting in that he had just gotten out of, it was either Soledad or San Quentin, and I'm not altogether clear which one it was, but he had just gotten out, and she hired him, and she, you know, she loved him as another son, really. You know, she loved the way he dressed because it reminded her of my dad.
And he was a sharp dresser.
Yeah, he was a very sharp dresser. And he was very, you know, he was well-read and conversant on, I mean, because when we first met him, he was talking to us younger ones about politics and not talking down to us, you know, asking us questions as though we were part of the mix and as though we were informed, which I have to say, I have to confess, that some of the questions he asked, talking about, but then, you know, to live up to his expectations, then I sure went and did my homework and found out about the questions he was asking.
Let me ask, I don't want to cut you. Where what was the address of the Teen Post? I know it was on San Pedro 70. What was actual address?
Central. I think it was 7901 Central, I believe.
Central Avenue. It was on Central Avenue. It wasn't on San Pedro?
No, 79th and Central. Not okay. On San Pedro. Yeah.
Where am I getting San Pedro from?
Because it was on San Pedro was the United Front that Robert M. and Hanzuki and where Maasai subsequently went. It was right across the street from Fremont.
I had left Los Angeles. I was a part of the Red Guard or the United Front, and I was Robert M. Wahanjuki, and we were down on Santa Barbara at the time, but I had left, and but I had met Bunchy at L.A., Los Angeles City College.
Mm-hmm.
When he went to City College, and your mother hired Maasai Hewitt, became part of the Red Guard or the United Front, and then he became the Minister of Education, I think, for the Black Panther Party, correct?
I think that's correct.
Yeah.
He was more of a theoretician than most.
Yes, you know, he was.
Yeah, he was indeed studious. You know, he theory seriously.
Now we have a few more minutes left, and like you know, we know that Bunchy was like a Renaissance man, but a lot of people don't realize Bunchy was a great swimmer, and he was he could act. Everybody talks about his dancing ability, but he was a great singer. Who did he sound like to you in terms of, he was singing falsetto, I guess, and I think falsetto was one of the weapons, but you wrote a piece on Facebook where you talked about some of the Stevie Wonder songs, some of the songs he used to sing.
Yeah, but he was at that time, there was the song I'm Wondering, and he used to sing I Was Made to Love Her. You know, I was born in Little Rock, had a childhood sweetheart. Yeah, he used to sing that. Yeah. And he was just such an amazing individual, because because there was no inhibition. You know, he was just see is what you get. And I was listening to your discussion with Brother Kamasi, and Kamasi was talking about how he would talk to the penal thugs. And
right.
And we actually saw him deal with LAPD like that. We were at Wrigley Field. There was an old Wrigley Field in L.A. And not to be confused with the Chicago Wrigley Field, but there was an event over there, and my mother pulled some strings and got Bunchy on the program to do a poem or two. And so anyway, that was an interesting story. That's we'll talk about that. But what happened is we were up in the stadium somewhere, and we were walking around, and so this LAPD cop came over to us, and Bunchy told him, I said, beat it, Goldilocks. He had just a flair. I mean, he was like a Earl Flynn or some, you know, just a flamboyance about him, you know. It's amazing.
Al Prentiss, Bunchy Carter was, he and Masa, I understand, both of them were born in Shreveport, Louisiana, but they, I don't know if Bunchy did any traveling. I haven't really, the research that I found, I don't think he ever went back to Shreveport, and he went to Oakland, but, you know, I don't have any knowledge about Bunchy going to Chicago or New York or anything like that. He basically, I guess, the 4 years he spent in prison, and he was well-read, and he knew the world situation, but he didn't live long enough, I guess, to do a lot of traveling, I guess.
That's my conclusion too, and I don't know factually if that's so, but that's my conclusion. I mean, I think I do know he was back and forth to Oakland quite a bit, and you know, the thing about it is that he was out basically. Here's the thing that's really hard for me that I go over from time to time is that he was arrested, and they were going to violate his parole and send him back to prison. And I remember my brother and I, my mom went to court, and my brother and I, we took off from school and went to court. And my mother put her house up, you know, for his bail. And, you know, that was a house that we grew up in. It was, we lived in it. We were the first people to live in it. It was a brand new house when we had moved in. And so if he had got some eldritch in him and left the country, we would have been, we'd have been out.
You'd have been homeless.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the kind of, you know, he had that integrity. He stayed, and so he wasn't violated. And so what happened is sometimes I think about if he had been violated, maybe he would have been, you know, gone back, and he may not have been taken out at UCLA when that happened, you know. But who's to say, you know, you never can. But, I mean, when I look back at it, I mean, it clearly shows, you know, just how my mother felt about him, you know, that she would put her house up, you know, put her house on the line
for Bunchy, Al Prentiss Bunchy Carter. That means she must have really had faith and loved him.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. Yeah. And when when he was assassinated on January 17th of '69, God, we were, you know, it just really, it broke her heart, and then it just really kind of devastated most of us around there, you know, most of us younger cats who were influenced by him. And I remember after we went to court and it was determined that he wasn't going to be violated, well, you know how they just take forever to quote-unquote process you. So we were waiting a day or so. He was supposed to get out. And so we remember waiting all day and almost into the wee hours of the morning. And finally he came out, and there's this brother who was his running buddy by the name of Wilbert Terry. And we were at his apartment waiting for Bunchy. And then so Bunchy came in and we were all excited. And then I remember him telling us that his parole officer, this cat, I remember his name being Diekman or Dykman or something like that, you know, told him something to the, you know, that, you know, Al, you should, you know, back these young guys off because they're gonna hurt. Somebody's going to get hurt. And it was just, you know, at that time when you hear that, you know, you can't, you know, it doesn't compute like that. But when you look back at it, it was like, you know, they had a plan in place, it seems to me, from early on.
And do you ever, Elaine Brown talked about how Bunchy talked about having a non-antagonistic contradiction with the US organization, and, you know, not, although they had these serious differences, not really trying to move on Coringa. Do you remember Bunchy ever talking about Ron Coringa at all?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because when we were at the team post, you know, Bunchy was organizing us. And it was really interesting because he was pulling together some of us young guys, and it hadn't really taken a form or a name or anything yet, but he was talking to us and we were meeting, and sure, it definitely came up, and I would say that we were sort of like forerunners to what would subsequently become the Radicals. That there was a group in it that came out of the team post called the Radicals, and I think my side was probably gone by that time. Wilbert Terry was one of them. A bunch of other guys that were around the team post were part of the Radicals, and of course Bunchy. And we were, as young guys, we were looking for organization, and Bunchy was telling us about, you know, we needed to get some equipment because otherwise we were going to be wearing ball heads and boobies, you know. So I remember one time Tommy Lewis, the late Tommy Lewis, one of the brothers who was killed on Adams and Montclair, along with Steve Bartholomew and Robert Lawrence. Tommy and I, we took a little tour. We went from the team post on 79th and Central to the United Front, which was on 77th and San Pedro, right across from Fremont High. And we visited and talked with Robert, and Masai, of course, was there. And, you know, and we were somewhat impressed with them. Then we, from there, we went to Broadway and to the US organization headquarters and visited them. And needless to say, we were not so impressed, you know, with the just the kind of
So do you remember when they used to sing, "I just want to testify"?
Yeah.
What my honor has done for me.
Yeah, the cult of personality. That's what I was looking for. Yeah, we were just not impressed with the cult of personality that was there. And then from there we went to the Black Congress, which was on, I think it was on Broadway as well. Do you remember the Black Congress? That was the umbrella organization?
The Black Congress started after I left.
Okay. Well, it was an umbrella organization for the Panthers, us, Nick, Core, all of them. They were there. And we didn't feel like we wanted to be a part of any of those organizations. We wanted something independent. And then subsequently to our visit, Eldridge Cleaver came to, firstly the Radicals formed, then Eldridge Cleaver came and visited the Teen Post and spoke on a Sunday. You know, the Radicals would have these Sunday meetings and they would really attract a nice crowd of people each Sunday, and
I remember I was there. That was the first time I saw Eldridge Cleaver, right?
And I remember one thing that he said that stuck out. You know, he had a flair for rhetoric. He said, "We want to get the community so uptight," and and then uptight in those days, of course, was like referencing Stevie's song, "Uptight." Everything's out of sight.
All right. Right.
Yeah. And so he said, "You want to get your community so uptight that if a pig does something to a brother, you put an ATV out on him." and oh my God, everybody loves that, you know, particularly in LA, you know.
But we only have about 2 minutes left, my good friend. I really appreciate this. I'd like for you, you can sum up now, and anything else you'd like to add with these 2 minutes?
Well, I guess the hard thing, you know, in having to reflect about this is that as I got to know Bunchy and saw the kind of integrity he had, you know, particularly towards myself and my younger brother as young people, you know, I mean, he could have just forced, you know, been, you know, just, you know, rode over us or something, but he was always really compassionate and thoughtful towards us and really patient and caring. And I thought, you know, that I'd have a lot of time with this newfound older brother. But it didn't work out like that, and I didn't even realize that he had such a large family. You know, all I knew is what I needed. You know, what my needs were, and
he had 10 brothers and sisters. Yeah,
exactly. As a family, yeah, 10 or 11 in the family. Yeah,
right.
It's a big family.
Well, and the last thing I want to let everybody know, his mother is still in the land of the living.
Yeah, Nola Carter. Yeah, she's amazing.
She's about 98 or 97, 98?
God, yeah, she's getting, yeah, she's in that range. I'm not quite sure, but she's definitely in that range, you know, mid to late 90s.
And she lost two sons, her old... Bunchy's older brother was the first Panther that was killed, Arthur Morris, and then mm-hmm. she has a son, Fatih, I think it's in Pelican Bay, I believe.
Yeah, Kenny Carter, yeah, whatever. I knew Kenny, I knew Gregory, and his sister, Sandra, and I were partners. She was my girl, you know. that was really interesting how that, but oh my God, yeah, we had some close ties there, you know. It's a lot of A lot of love there.
All right, my friend, I really appreciate this interview, and keep up your good work, and we will see you in the whirlwind.
Okay, thank you so much for the opportunity to reflect on this. You know, it means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
All right, take care. And we have been speaking with Raymond Nat Turner, and Diasporic Music continues on Uhuru Radio.
Uhuru Radio.
Black power in black community.
And we're calling on all Africans. We recognize that as a people, we have tremendous skills in our community.
Informative.
So we've got to take all the skills that we've learned. You know, we've got to take all of our energy, and we've got to find a way to contribute to making sure that African people have a future.
No degrading lyrics.
Africa is the future. Africa is the future. There ain't no future unless we build it now.
Finally, the station you've been looking for. Uhuru Radio.
Come, join us on the 2015 Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise, a fun-filled, African-centered cruise aboard the Carnival Splendor, departing from the port of Miami, Florida, making stops in Cozumel, Belize, Honduras, and the Cayman Islands. With the unique perspective and insight of Omali Yeshitela, chairman of the African Socialist International, we invite Africans everywhere, as well as friends and allies, to share in this amazing experience of African culture, history, great food, and friendship, all on a relaxing cruise for 8 days from November 29th to December 6th, 2015. For more details and reservations for the 2015 Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise, call our exclusive agency, Tanya's Travel, at 352-693-3034. You may also log on to yahoolegacycruise.org to view the itinerary and pricing information. Call today, because procrastination is the thief of time. The 2015 Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise, setting sail November 29th through December 6th. Call Tanya's Travel at 352-693-3034. That's 352-693-3034. Or log on to yahoolegacycruise.org, and we'll see you on the open seas.
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio, and we just talked to Raymond Nat Turner, and we're getting ready to listen to a song that Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, John Huggins, and Elaine Brown used to sing. It's called Love for My Baby, but Elaine says that they changed the words to I've Got Love for My People. Young Hearts are from Dorsey High School, and Dorsey High School is the high school that produced Eric Allen Dolphy Jr. and the many, many, many others. But here is the Young Hearts and I've Got Love for My Baby, or as Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, Elaine Brown, and John Huggins would say, I've Got Love for My People.
Oh,
Alafia, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We are paying tribute to Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter, and the Young Hearts. We've just played the Young Hearts. I've Got Love for My Baby. And like I said, as Elaine Brown and Bunchy Carter and John Huggins used to change the words to that song, I've Got Love for My People. But Dorsey High School was the high school of a group called the Vibrations. And the Vibrations featured a young man by the name of Richard Owens. And Richard Owens went on to replace Eddie Kendricks in the Temptations. And Ricky Owens didn't last that long in the Temptations. He was having some problems, but Ricky Owens was a tall, nice-looking fella. And Otis Williams mentioned Richard Owens in his book, and he said that when Eddie left, Richard was the first person that they thought about contacting to replace Eddie Kendricks. And they went to the same high school as the Young Hearts, and they did a song called Misty, a great song called Misty. And we're going to listen to two renditions of Misty, one by the Vibrations featuring Richard Owens on lead, and another version of Misty by the Young Hearts, and the 1968 rendition of the Young Hearts. The Young Hearts rendition is from 1968, and the Vibrations rendition, I believe, is from 1961. So let's kick back and listen to the Vibrations and the Young Hearts perform Errol Garner's Misty.
Misty,
Community.
McKinney Clemente up in the Green Party. No disrespect, we need a rare black and green party.
Informative.
How wealth gets redistributed is that the workers themselves come to power. The workers come to power and then we redistribute the wealth, not the petty bourgeoisie.
No degrading lyrics. The station you've been looking for. Uhuru Radio.
Uhuru. I am Mayembe Malaika. I support Burning Spear Media and Norman Otis Richmond. Will you? Burning Spear Media keeps alive African culture from North America, the Caribbean, Africa, and the world. We have not forgotten Patrice Emery Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Mbolo. Burning Spear Media keeps them alive. Uhuru News and Radio connects African people worldwide. Burning Spear Media is owned and controlled by the African working class. Yes, bless you.
Good things, gotta back up, get ready, fulfill the task. Good things.
Uhuru, you're listening to the bluesologist Norman Otis Richmond, aka Jalali, on Uhuru Radio, and we are paying tribute to the Young Hearts during this segment. The Young Hearts were a group of young men from Los Angeles, California. They went to a high school called Dorsey High School, which produced the Vibrations, and many people went to Dorsey High School. I believe Billy Preston may have gone there. I might be wrong, but I think Billy Preston went to Dorsey High School. And they did a song called Do You Have the Time? And at one time I did a radio show on Chin Radio. The name of my show was Do You Have the Time? And it was a young man by the name of Bill Payne, a Euro-American gentleman, had an excellent show. And he gave me the space to do a show called
Do You Have the Time? And we're going to listen to Do You Have the Time? These are the Young Hearts from Los Angeles, California. And this show is dedicated to the memory of John Huggins and Al Prentice, Bunchy Carter.
You know, a lot of us go through life never realizing our true potential, never really pursuing our positive goals. Sometimes we even procrastinate to ourselves and say what we can do tomorrow instead of what we can do today, further saying that if it wasn't for this, then I would have that. But what we are really doing is missing the whole point. As an old man once told me, son, if you don't wake up, you're gonna miss the boat. And this is what we let happen to a lot of our lives. Sometimes we fail to ask ourselves that main question, and that is, do we really have the time to waste our life away? Do we have the time to go through life always putting things off instead of really bearing down and working diligently into bringing the best of us out? You know, this is a brand new day. Each and every morning that you open your eyes is the beginning of the rest of your life. So sometimes when trouble seems to get us down and life really seems too hard to bear, then we must pick ourselves up and then ask ourselves that question again. Do you really have time to waste our life away?
Got to lose, and who gives a drop?
You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali. And joining me on the line from Oakland, California is Elaine Brown. Elaine Brown is an Oakland, California-based former leader of the Black Panther Party and author of A Taste of Power, a 1992 publication, and The Condemnation of Little B, which was published in 2002. Greetings, Elaine Brown. How are you doing today?
I'm well under all the circumstances of life in the United States.
I understand that. Now, Al Prentice Bunchy Carter was born on October 12, 1942. And why do you feel that black youth and all oppressed humanity should remember and commemorate Al Prentice Bunchy Carter?
Well, Bunchy was certainly Bunchy was only 26 years old when he was assassinated, so his life wasn't very long, and so the record of his life is not very big because it was a short life, but a very powerful life. But the most significant part of his life, of course, was the fact that he organized the first chapter of the Black Panther Party outside of Oakland, or in fact the first chapter of the party, therefore, in the Southern California chapter in early 1968. And he was a powerful leader, remembering that it was only a year that he was a leader of the Black Panther Party because he was assassinated in January of 69. So the significance of that 1 year and who he was with respect to Los Angeles and why, therefore, he was assassinated are important in terms of the history of the black ongoing struggle for black liberation.
Well, you know, it's very ironic that he and John Huggins was from New Haven, Connecticut. They were both assassinated on January 17, 1969, and 8 years before that, Patrice Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Mpolo were assassinated in the Congo. So January 17th is a very, very important day. And I was going to John C. Fremont at that time when the Lumumba was assassinated. The word was given in February, a month later, that he had been assassinated. And Abby Lincoln and Maya Angelou and Rosa Guy, a sister from Trinidad, led a demonstration, and they tore the UN up. Do you remember how Bunchy felt about? Could you talk about Bunchy's international outlook? I know he really liked Dessalines from Haiti, and he also liked Dedan Kimathi from the Land and Freedom Army, or the Mau Mau. Could you talk about Bunchy's international outlook?
Well, I think the most important thing is not who he liked, but the fact that he was conscious of the struggles that were taking place around the world for liberation, particularly those in Africa. So it wasn't a question of Lumumba per se. It was a question of these were the struggles that were going on throughout the continent that he was fully conscious of. And for a young man, this was quite amazing. I don't think that there's a whole generation of people then or now in that age group who really have a consciousness of, have a world view. I can't explain why Bunchy had that kind of worldview, why he was a student. He spent 4 years in prison before he got out and became a leader of the Black Panther Party. He read a lot. He was originally a follower of the Nation of Islam, certainly dedicated to the Malcolm X wing, we can say. And once Malcolm left, and brought a lot of the nation, brought a lot of the perspective that he had learned from these other leaders and these other movements. So I think that, like Huey Newton, whom he was very much like, he, as a person who was from the streets of Los Angeles and who was deemed a leader of one of the largest street organizations or gangs, as people call it, in the country, the Slaussons, that it was quite incredible that he would come from that history and be so incredibly learned and conscious. So while you might have been in high school, I mean, it doesn't really matter what our personal experiences are. The question would be that he brought, as a leader of the new first chapter of the Black Panther Party, he brought to all of us a consciousness about the struggles around the world and our relationship to those struggles, remembering that all of the African struggles were basically led by people who were Marxist-Leninists, and that the Black Panther Party itself was a Marxist-Leninist ideology. That doesn't mean we didn't have a consciousness of Black people, because that is exactly what our goal was, the liberation of Black people. It was our primary and only goal, really. So I say all of that to say that we have to have an objective analysis of situations, because that's one thing that Bunchy had. For example, well, I can talk more about the Karenga piece, and I'm certainly not going to not talk about Bunchy Carter and talk about who assassinated him. But there was an incident in May of 1968 where someone from the Black Panther Party, as it turned out, we shared a big space. There was a big place called the Black Congress, and we shared a lot of Black organizations had a little office in the Black Congress. That was the whole point of it. Now, when I think back on it, I don't know who funded the Black Congress, probably some poverty program. But in any case, the office space was available to almost anybody who could use it. And so we had an office, and the US organization had an office in the Black Congress, and Karenga's picture was on the front, on their door of their office. And someone, apparently from the Black Panther Party, wrote some nasty things across Karenga's face on that picture, across the picture of Karenga on that door. And apparently the Karenga sent some of his so-called Simbas, meaning some warriors, as he liked to imagine they were, to Bunchy's house, threatening him. And Bunchy came and talked to us because we were having our weekly Wednesday meeting. And so you had, by this time, there were probably 150 to 200 people who were joining the party, who had joined the party by then, or who nominally joined the party. I don't know if they lasted, but they certainly were there in that meeting. And he came to that meeting and preached to us for 2 hours about why we had to have non-antagonistic relationships with other Black organizations, no matter what our opinions would be of their positions. He also recognized neocolonialism. He recognized that Blacks could be the enemy of Blacks, so it wasn't like he was naive, but he issued an order, and that order was that the Black Panther Party Southern California chapter would not engage in antagonistic confrontations with any other Black organization. And why is that important? Because he recognized that what was going on around the world was using Blacks against each other, and the whole neocolonial piece that comes from the analysis, of course, of Nkrumah. So all of this is tied to his understanding of what we as Black people in the United States had to do to begin to wage to create the conditions for revolution and for revolutionary change in America.
I'm speaking with Elaine Brown, the author of A Taste of Power and the Condemnation of a Little Bee. Now, once you joined the Nation of Islam, I guess when he was 15, and when he was in prison, with Eldridge, and Eldridge and him, I guess Bunchy joined the Panthers before Eldridge, I believe.
I don't actually know, and honestly, I don't care. I don't know that Eldridge Cleaver ever joined the Black Panther Party. Eldridge Cleaver came out of prison after doing 9 years on rape, came out of prison and began to work for Ramparts magazine. He never identified himself at that time as a Black Panther member, and nobody else did. He was in something called the Afro-American something or other in a cultural group, actually, in Northern California.
Yes, right.
And so what their relationship was, my Eldridge didn't start a chapter of the party, Bunchy did. Eldridge identified himself as a minister of information after Huey P. Newton was shot and charged with the murder of a cop in Oakland, which was in 67. So I honestly don't know that history, and I don't know the relevance of it.
Now, what are your thoughts on Stanley Nelson's film, the new Black Panther film?
Well, I've written, I wrote a piece that was published in the Daily Beast about in July or so, giving my complete opinion of it. But in essence, I consider it to be not only revisionist, but the demonization of Huey Newton that Stanley figures out how to do at the end of the film, which is in lockstep with the FBI's characterization of Huey, ends up casting the entire Black Panther Party as a kind of group of, you know, for a moment, swashbuckling, and then really just followers of this insane and maniacal man, as he describes it, and some of these erstwhile Panthers describe Huey. And so the film becomes really a demonization of the entire Black Panther Party. So I not only denounce the film, but I denounce Stanley, and I've told him this, and I've asked him to remove the footage that he has of me from the film, which he has refused to do. And as I indicate in my review of this film, my only solace in any of this is that no one will ever remember Stanley Nelson, but we will all still be studying the Black Panther Party, and certainly the works and the writings and the theories of Huey P. Newton.
This is a question that I've always wanted to ask you. I know Bunchy was a Renaissance man. I mean, he could he was revolutionary first and foremost, but I mean, he could do a lot of things. He was a great swimmer. He was a singer, and you said he sang falsetto, and you sang contralto, and John Huggins sang bass. Did you guys ever sing? I read or heard somewhere that you guys used to sing that song, "I've Got Love for My Baby" by the Young Hearts. Or did I get this, that misinformation?
Well, John Huggins did that. I mean, I wouldn't say that a bunch. We all sang together and had this nice little thing. But we always kept the movement in everything we did. You know, one of the internal slogans of the party: no part-time Panthers, 24-hour revolutionaries. So there wasn't a day or an hour that we weren't committed to doing something. So even if we had a moment to enjoy ourselves, we were doing it in a context of organizing or in the context of remembering what we needed to remember in another way. So, John, there was that song, Young Hearts, I've Got Love. I guess it was the Young Hearts.
It was Young
Hearts,
I've
Got Love
right.
for My Baby. I remember that John used to sing that I've Got Love. We used to change it to I've Got Love for My People. But Fred Hampton did that also when
right.
he transformed the Diana Ross song with the Supremes. Someday We'll Be Together. He transformed that into meaning our people will be together, and it was playing all through the streets of Chicago on bullhorns and everything on on trucks blasting that song out because it was so popular. And after Fred was assassinated, as a kind of tribute, and so it was a really interesting crossover and use of the music, and then ultimately a group that the Black Panther Party formed, a singing group called The Lumpin', about which there's a book out called Party Music, sing versions of popular songs with revolutionary or lyrics about our people. So that was something that we did. That was something that we did a lot.
I don't want to cut you, but yeah, Ricky Vincent has that book out called Party Music. Ricky Vincent.
That's what I just said.
Yeah.
I just said that.
Oh, I know what you said.
Ricky Vincent did not bother to interview me, however. And I wrote and sang songs, and I wrote a song called that became known as the Black Panther Party National Anthem, but he figured out how to never contact me for a book called Party Music.
Assassination. You did Assassination. Is that the song you're talking about? It was another song.
It was another song. It was originally called The Meeting, that became known as the Black Panther Party National Anthem. Assassination was a song I wrote for John and Bunchy, as a tribute, really, not even as a tribute, but just because it was an expression of my response to their murder.
Well, the song, was the song recorded that Ricky did not mention?
Yes, it's on my first album. The song's called Seizure Time, along with the song Assassination.
Okay,
which actually has come out, which has now been digitized, and people can actually get it through iTunes and Amazon CD and all this other stuff, which is just amazing to me, from a 1969 album. But there you are. And people are buying it, amazing, apparently.
Well, you work with Horace Tapscott on some of your albums or all of your albums.
Well, I did two albums, and Horace was certainly the orchestrated both of them, and one of my very dearest friends.
Yeah, great, 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 great man from Los Angeles.
Right.
I have two more questions.
Okay.
This is 2015. What does Elaine Brown feel should and can be done in this period?
Well, I'm doing what I think can be done right now. I have organized a nonprofit, as it were, much as I can't stand that concept because it reminds me of because there's so many nonprofit pimps, like a throwback to the poverty program era. But I have organized a nonprofit called Oakland and the World Enterprises, and we have been able to acquire a 3/4-acre piece of land at 7th and Campbell Streets in West Oakland, and we are developing that land to create businesses, to establish businesses that we will launch, finance, and support and sustain to profitability, to be cooperatively owned by people, formerly incarcerated people. Right now we have created for that space, that one of the businesses is taking up. We've cleared most of the property, and we have an urban farm there called West Oakland Farms. And all of the workers, the farmers there are, on one hand, they're earning $20 an hour. At the same time, they are buying an interest into ownership of West Oakland Farms through their sweat equity. So we have about 10 formerly incarcerated people working there, and we produce a lot of nice product, vegetables and what have you. We're selling to a couple of really nice restaurants, both all black owned. Although we're not restricted, but that's what we have right now. We also just made a contract with the Oakland Public Schools to sell some of our products. And so we're building that piece up so that people can become self-determining and somewhat independent in this existing scheme. I would say that the throwback is to the Black Panther Party concept of the survival program. And this is a survival program for those people who are not going to survive 1 minute in this society coming out of the joint unless they have tremendous support systems in place, as you probably are well aware. So that's one of the things I'm doing, given the absence of a mass movement in America. I'm doing the best I can. At the same time, as I have been, I'm focused on people who are in prison, and my greatest focus is on little B, Michael Lewis, who remains incarcerated, going into 19 years. He was 13 years old when he was arrested in 1997, and he is still in prison for a murder that he did not commit, convicted. And by the time he was 14, he was in an adult facility in Georgia. And I am doing everything I can, although I never thought that I would be unable to move enough pieces around to not have this young man out of prison by now. He's going to have a parole hearing or review in February, and so I'm going to try to build up the momentum through the various social networks to get support, get people to sign petitions for his release after 19 years, even if he had done it. In any case, a child, nobody should be putting a child in prison at 13, and certainly shouldn't have, his entire life has been spent there, and he's now 32 years old. So that's what I'm doing. As far as what the rest could be done, you know, I would like to hope that the Black Panther Party and a man like Bunchy Carter would be held up as an exemplar of what we might want to do. And, you know, Bunchy expressed it in his words and in his deeds, and that is to commit ourselves to the struggle for liberation. And, you know, to paraphrase Gil Scott-Heron, the revolution will not be Twittered or Facebooked, but there's a lot of people out here now who think that it will, and that they can, you know, just send out a lot of messages and have a rally here or there, and that's the end of the conversation, and no action needs to be taken. I was very just mortified to see one of these Black Lives Matter young men in an interview on one of these news stations yesterday saying they had met with Hillary Clinton, a warmonger.
Right.
But they sat down with this warmongering woman whose husband is singularly responsible for mass incarceration of particularly Blacks at 50%, and sat down with her for the second time and came away saying, while we didn't agree, this is what this young Negro said, I felt heard. And all I could think of was how the slaves from the fourth quarter would send a representative up to the big house and talk to Miss Ann and ask Miss Ann, can we get a chicken out there in the fourth quarter from time to time? Miss Ann, I hear you and I will get back to you. So that's the mindset that I think is pervasive in this new age, what I call new age racism, where the victim is responsible for the crime. That is to say, where Black people, our only thing is that if we would just uplift ourselves, we could do that because America's a great place. Or we just want to be recognized. Once we're recognized, we're happy to work with a warmongering Hillary Clinton. We don't have any problem as long as she embraces us in her scheme, and remembering that it is still not our house. We don't have a house and we don't control anything. So the analysis is that right now people can say what they want to say about what the various so-called movements might be, but in the end of the day, the example of Bunchy Carter and the Black Panther Party has to be revisited, and not through the eyes of some reprobate revisionist named Stanley Nelson, but through a real analysis of the work. In October of next year, as you probably realize, we are going to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party. And in Oakland, we are the host area because this was the base of the party. So we're working very hard to develop an agenda of programming and things that people can attend, where we can truly review the history of the party, or the true history, and talk about what we did, why we did it, and where we might go from here.
We have a few more minutes, and I wanted to get your thoughts on, an independent party. I know you were affiliated with the Green Party at one time. What do you think about the coming election? I know you're not down with Hillary, but the Green Party, the independent political party, a Black political independent political party, or an independent labor party, and how do you see the 2016 elections with the brother man from the motherland, Barack Hussein Obama, stepping down? And I know he's not going to give amnesty to Mumia Abu-Jamal or Leonard Peltier. I just want to say that.
Well, I consider, Mumia and Leonard Peltier, but what about Little B? See, one of the problems that we have is we popularize one or two people, but we forget there's a mass incarceration going on. And there's a boy who was incarcerated for political reason. We have to know what is a political prisoner. And there's George Jackson, who defined that and developed the whole prisoner movement concept. With whom we have basically forgotten, not to count Jonathan Jackson. So, yes, of course, but there's many other people. You have a brother named Chip Fitzgerald in Los Angeles. coming out of Los Angeles, 19 years old when he went to prison in 1969, and it's still in
prison. He's still in prison, right.
And we don't raise up Chip Fitzgerald's name, who was actually in the Black Panther Party, as Leonard Peltier was actually in the AIM organization movement. So I would hope that we would broaden our scope to get beyond certain individuals and see the big picture about all of the young, all of the brothers and sisters who are incarcerated, as to the whole political scope of why we have 50% black. Everybody was poor. You don't have rich people in prison. You have most of the people who didn't even finish high school, that kind of thing. And that this is a nation that that incarcerates more people by number and percentages than any other in the world, including China, Russia, and Cuba, that this country likes to denounce. So I just think that perspective always has to be there, and we can't get caught up in too much individualization and personalization of cases and then let the other issues go by the wayside, because we'll become very involved and we'll be distracted from the bigger issue. As for the presidency, Barack Obama did exactly what anyone would have expected if they had had a minimal analysis of anything, and that is he became the president of the United States, and he did exactly what he was supposed to do. The only difference is that because he was allegedly black, or mixed race, as I'm sure some people like to say, knowing that race is not a, a definition of anything but a social definition, but Obama did something different. He was able to get a country that was very angry at the right, at George Bush, having no memory of the horrors of the Clinton administration, because Negroes just loved Bill Clinton to the point where people like Toni Morrison and Chris Rock identified Bill Clinton as the first black president. So by their definition, Obama was actually the second black president. But in any case, Obama offered the right an opportunity to gain their to reinstate their agenda with the support of so-called liberals and progressives, because people thought he represented something different and some kind of miraculous way was going to change the country in some substantive way. In fact, what he did was not only maintain the status quo, but did things that George Bush wouldn't have gotten away with, and did things that were worse than Bush, such as not recognizing, not even letting people out of prison with his presidential powers, even though he would go to the federal prison and say, it was the first time he visited prison at the end of his second term, a visit to a federal prison, really. Nothing has changed. But and I like to use this, the assassination by the CIA of Muammar Gaddafi was, to me, one of the most shameful things that Obama did, that George Bush would have never gotten away from. It was so shameful away with. It was so, and his complete support of and boosting of AFRICOM on the continent is such that, and to call and then pretend, as the CIA does, that this was a, quote, the people overthrew Gaddafi and it was the Arab Spring. I don't know how they connect all those eyeball pieces, but that's how they did it, and they sold it. But what was more shameful is nobody black in the diaspora seemed to be upset about it, that had a voice. Certainly not some of the other leaders on the continent. They just went along with it and were silent to this incredible assassination of the one and only African leader who was prepared and was urging and was organizing what Nkrumah had tried to do, a union of African states, because independently they're not making it. So that's that. As far as an independent party in America, at this time, it's not going to be a success. So the question would be, if you want success or you just want to give lip service to an educational campaign. I am not a supporter of the Green Party, just so we get it straight. I ran once for the nomination for the Green Party president. And the racism that was so pervasive in the Green Party at the time was such that they weren't going to have it. And then they tried to cure that, because I charged them with that by promoting Cynthia McKinney. But the point is, I don't have anything to do with the Green Party, so, and certainly the other party, Democrat, Republican Party, is absolutely nothing. I don't think that if there's a way for us to use electoral politics, and there certainly is, it has to be in a way that you can make it meaningful. That would be, at this stage, local. So people, because right now we have local leaders, plantation Negroes, bootlicking Negroes that are just getting away with everything, including murder. You don't have people speaking out about it. We have all these people filming Eric Garner. Where are the blacks who are elected in New York? Why aren't they enraged over this? Where are the elected blacks in Ferguson and so forth? You know, doing nothing with their elected positions. Same thing here in Oakland. So what you have is a collection of Negroes who have gotten their way into these positions through the blood of Fannie Lou Hamer and the Black Panther Party and so forth, and have done nothing to uphold the legacy and the duty they have to pay attention to the interests of black people. So I think that if there is an electoral, if there's a way to use the electoral machine as it exists, then I think that local politics could be effective. But certainly on a national level, it's irrelevant. There's no black national elected party, labor party, that's going to do anything but talk at this point. It requires tremendous, either you've got a lot of money or a lot of guns. And since I know that we don't have any money, and we're not going to be picking up any guns at this stage, it seems evident, then I suggest that if we were to think about the electoral political scene, that the only thing we could be thinking about was the use of that machine in local elections where we could actually win and take charge. And that is a place where I think it probably wouldn't matter what party you're with, because most of these electoral local positions are very often nonpartisan. And if they are, you can still win with an independent party in a local election because you have maybe the numbers are with you.
All right, and I would like to thank you for this interview, and thank you for, I think we should think about Bunchy on October the 12th and every day, and our Prentice Bunchy Carter is one of the most important leaders that we have produced, and I hope to, with the help of the people, to, you know, keep remembering Bunchy on, like I say, October 12th and every day.
Well, I would agree. For me, he was my hero. I was fortunate enough to know him and to interact with him. And I was unfortunate enough to be there on the scene when he was assassinated. And so there, especially on January 17th of every year, and it's been all of these years since 1969, Bunchy is in my heart on a personal level, and I certainly agree that he must be elevated to become a member of the pantheon of black heroes that we have. And I have framed pictures of Bunchy in several places in my home because he's such an important person in my life. And I believe in the history of the Black Panther Party, and that the Black Panther Party stands today as the, probably, I don't think history will disagree at this stage, the greatest effort made by black people in America for liberation.
All right. With that, I'll say thank you very much and talk to you again at another time.
All right. Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right, and you have been listening to Elaine Brown, and this is Norman Otis Richmond, and we will see you in a whirlwind. Uhuru, you have been listening to the Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We would like to thank Raymond Nat Turner and Elaine Brown for excellent interviews, and I would like to thank Lisa Watson for her technical brilliance today. This is Norman Otis Richmond saying that we will see you in the whirlwind, and take care of yourself.